Nice to have you here.
Well, thank you.
Tell me, before we talk about Eve's mm-hmm. tattoo, tell me a little bit about yourself and where you're from and all of that. Background.
Background, personal yeah. stuff. Okay. I was born in Tucson, Arizona, and I spent the first 6 years of my life in Houston, Texas. And then I lived a couple of years in New York, and then I went overseas. My father was in the Air Force, and I lived in Formosa for about 3 years in Hong Kong. And then I came back to New York and I went to, I don't know what you call it, pre-high school and high school and college in New York City.
You're at Hunter?
Barnard and Brearley.
Uh-huh.
Great Stirrup School.
And you went to Barnard?
Mm-hmm.
And you studied English?
No, I studied anthropology.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
What did you expect to work for the Museum of Natural History?
Well, I was also an actress. I was always an actress from the time I was about 12 years old. And when I went to Barnard, I was already on a soap opera. So it was always the choice between becoming actually an anthropologist or becoming an actress. And I became an actress instead.
Yeah, that's right. I saw in some of the little publicity material about you that you were on the soap. What was the name of that soap opera?
Edge of Night.
How long were you on that?
I was on it for about 4.5 years.
When was this?
A long time ago. When it was live on CBS, as a matter of fact.
Well, it must have been a great experience.
Well, it was a lot. It was a great experience.
But you must have been very young at the time.
I was very young at the time. And it was a great experience. And also, I don't believe I've ever made as much money since then.
So you kind of let anthropology go by the boards.
Well, you know, for a long time I did entertain the idea of going back to graduate school. And then in circumstance, I started working for the National Lampoon Radio Hour after I stopped working on the soap opera. And then once I was working for the National Lampoon, I started writing. And once I was writing, then I was happy. And I decided not to be an anthropologist. But the truth is that I use my anthropological training in my writing. I'm very interested in the structure of things. And for example, in the Footbinder story, it's all about the structure of footbinding. You know, and how it worked within the society and what purposes it served and how people endorsed it as opposed to opposed it. And I'm always interested in that. And also in Cleon Zhu's divorce is very much about the structure of success.
Do you read the Gideon Oliver mysteries?
I don't, actually.
He is an anthropologist, detective.
Uh-huh. And, oh, really? I should read this.
Yeah. Aaron Elkins is the author. Oh, he has a whole series. I think he's written about 8 of them.
Really? Oh.
So the Gideon Oliver series of anthropological detective mysteries.
Mm-hmm.
Be right down your alley. They're light and fun.
Right.
I also see that you write a column for Penthouse.
Yes.
It's been years since I picked up a copy of Penthouse,
yes.
So I wasn't aware of that. Tell me about the column.
It's political and social satire. Column. I've been doing it for about 13 years. I always say that as a feminist, I'm in the missionary position over at Penthouse. And I'm very grateful to them because they've made it possible for me to be a fiction writer. They're supporting me all these years.
Well, tell me, what themes do you tackle in this column?
Well, for example, I've just thrown my hat in the ring and I'm now running for president against Pat Buchanan. That's the column I just wrote.
Well, I know who I would vote for.
Who?
need you ask?
let's see. All different kinds of subjects, mostly having to do with politics. I had one I wrote, I guess, last year was it was the United Arab Emirate Awards, the Emmy Awards for hostage video programming. This is before the hostages. It was basically done just like an Emmy Awards ceremony. For the giving out awards to the Hezbollah, people have made hostage, and video entertainment. Who brought it? Using all that language. I'm a parodist, a black humorist and a parodist. So using all the language of the Emmy Awards to talk about, how foul it is that they were using all these hostages. What else? I happen to write a great many feminist columns this year because people have been thinking about these issues so much. Not because I always do. I don't always. I write about anything that's happening.
What a wonderful idea, a feminist column in a men's magazine.
Well, I always say I'm a female supremacist. It's beyond that. I mean, it's been a very hard-hitting, very black, and mostly about political issues in the world, but from, you know, particular slants.
Well, maybe I'm going to have to start reading Penthouse again. Go back to my college days.
An excuse.
What's that?
Everyone likes the excuse.
Well, in my college days, I used to read Playboy. I remember, and I would save them. They would stack up, you know, and I would have them in the proper sequence, like I was, like it was when I was a kid, when I put all my science fiction magazines together by year, volume, number, and this sort of thing.
Yeah.
But over the years, I don't know, somehow these men's magazines seem to have lost a lot of their luster.
Well, yes. I mean, you know, ever since they went after them, they, you know, when they go after you in terms of censorship, it, I think it always takes a little bit of your luster away because everybody becomes very self-censoring. I'm not a person that writes very blue stuff, but all of a sudden, because we have such a big market in Canada and because they took us off the stands in the South, it became more important for us to fit in with the censorship laws of Canada, which are much stricter, and so everybody was a little bit constrained. You know, and I think this happened. You know, the Mies Commission did a lot of damage in that area.
Well, I think that was good news yesterday, the Supreme Court ruling 8-0, striking down the Son of Sam law.
Oh, what was that? I missed that.
That was the, it's on the front page of the Times today.
Uh-huh.
It's the law that required people convicted of crimes to turn over the profits of any of their writing to the Crime Victims Compensation Board.
Mm-hmm.
But the Supreme Court ruled that it was a violation of their First Amendment right of free speech.
Mm-hmm.
Further, a criminal, someone convicted of a crime, say he had invested in real estate or stocks or bonds or something like that, the profits from those investments were not taken from him or her.
Uh-huh.
It also applied to women. That Jean Harris, for example, lost her money from her book, although she didn't want it for herself, but she was not entitled to determine how it should be disposed of. But they just singled out books.
Well, that's interesting. Yeah.
And so it was ruled...
Not movies? Not TV movies?
I don't know. Writing, books, I think. You know? Essentially writing, but, but primarily books.
That's
interesting. And there were several celebrated cases. The Nick Pileggi's Wise Guy, which was made into a film. That money was taken from Henry Hill. He was paid almost $100,000, and they took it away from him. That prompted the actual suit. It also dealt, although David Berkowitz, the multiple serial killer, he never wrote anything, I don't believe, but they were afraid he was going to write a story because he had a lot of offers to tell his story, right? And so some conservative politicians decided that they would head off any profits that he could make from telling his story by having this law enacted.
On the other hand, in my presidential platform, I was saying that I feel that we've come to reward the criminals and not reward the honest, and this is a real problem in the country. And that, for example, I don't see why the Michael Milkins of the world shouldn't pay 20 or 30 times the taxes I pay in retaliation, as opposed to, I don't care if he goes to jail or not, but I do care that I don't have to pay for his crime. And I do think that, there should be some, you know, amelioration of the situation.
What are some of the other planks in your platform?
Well, I was setting forth basically my you know, political ideology and what it is that I think we have this bad attitude that came to us during the Reagan years, which is to reward those who have criminally made money, you know, or made money out of greed. We reward them. I began to notice this when I went to the bank, and for the first time in 10 years, I couldn't cash my payroll check. And the woman told me that the reason I couldn't is because the policy for 10 years had been wrong, and they were carrying me, carrying a loan to me. I said, yes, but you have my savings accounts to use at your will. Well, she said, that has nothing to do with it. I said, well, I'm working for a Fortune 500 company. It's not a little fly-by-night company. For 10 years, my check's been good, and you've put it in as cash for me, because it's a, you know, a New Jersey check would take 10 days, right? She wouldn't do it. All of a sudden, and furthermore, treated me as if I was a criminal in some way. And I thought, wait a minute, you know, what's wrong with this? What's wrong with this picture? So I didn't do anything. You know, I'm doing the same thing I did for 13 years. So that was just a small inkling I had, began to have.
Well, I think it was time for you to change banks.
Well, you know, if I changed...
Or was this just an aberration?
Fall,
was
know?
This an aberration?
No.
The bank
no.
changed
the
its
bank
policy.
The bank began to change. You know, the bank began to change it suddenly. As do things like Con Ed. If you call up, I got a bill for $780 for electric. You know, I called up. And I said, well, if you want to check the computer, you'll find my bill's always been $40. This month it's $780. Well, you know, he treated me like a criminal. You know, the assumption was I did something. I hooked up some, you know, giant computer, mainframe computer in my apartment or something. You know, I said, how could this be? Well, you know, you must have done something. Anyway, I think that attitude should be changed. My second thing was that we're suffering from bad management. All the way across the board, bad. Just bad management. People who don't have foresight, people who don't plan ahead, you know? And these are the two things I would change overall in America. More emphasis on managing for the future. You know? I haven't gotten into the specifics yet, obviously, but I do believe this. But for one thing, for example, I would do. If you want to stop cocaine from coming into the country, I'd use the Army and I'd use Schwarzkopf because the man is a fantastic... logistics expert.
You can't use Schwarzkopf. He retired.
Well, call him back.
But I hope that if you ran for president, if you really ran for president, that you would be one of the first to have a domestic policy. The current administration and the one before that had no domestic policy whatsoever.
I would certainly start with drugs because drugs are a terrific problem and sapping a lot of our strength. You know, and the way I would do that is I would use the Army. I wouldn't take the Army to fight wars across the ocean. I would have them right here if we need to patrol the borders. We have an Army to do that. We have people who know how to fight war. We can use those people to stop drugs coming into our country instead of doing nothing. What are we doing? I can't even...
No, we're not doing anything with regard to the drug problem, but don't you think that rather than take a military approach, that it might be wiser to try to determine what makes people take drugs to begin with and try to stop that?
I certainly wouldn't put that at, you know... not entertain that. Obviously, we need more drug rehab rooms. We need a place for people to get off drugs as well. But meanwhile, you know, I just hear these people say we're going to fight a war on drugs and then nothing happens. I mean, it seems to me we could actually do that and employ a great number of people in doing it and have drug rehabilitation as well.
So on a monthly basis, you're beginning to outline your presidential policy.
That's absolutely
in Penthouse.
Correct. That's right.
Well, let's get back to your books. This is, I believe, your third novel. Is that correct?
It's my second novel and my third book of fiction.
Well, let's go back a little bit and talk about your first novel, the title of which?
Glianzu's Divorce.
And tell me about how that came about. Somewhere along the line, you began to get away from acting and
this sort of thing,
and you began to switch over to... The writing, and I just wonder how that transition was made and how that first novel came about.
Well, I started writing for the National Lampoon, is what happened.
Yes.
And I was in humor, and then I wrote for magazines. And I had a fan in an editor at Crown then called Larry Freundlich. And Larry Freundlich came to me and he said, I want you to write something for me. And I said, well, okay, what? And he said, fiction. I want you to write short stories. And I said, well, okay. So I wrote a book of short stories called A Visit from the Footbinder, and that's the first book of fiction that I wrote.
Did Larry Freundlich pay you, by the way?
Oh, yes, he did.
He did. Most of his authors never got paid.
No,
as you know that.
That was before.
He spent much of his time in court and eventually went bankrupt.
He moved to Simon & Schuster, so I published it with Simon & Schuster, as it were, because actually he left at that time. And
to form his own.
Yes, he formed his own company.
He formed Freundlich Books.
Yeah. And
so you published Simon & Schuster before he left.
Let's say exactly at the moment.
That he left.
You lucked out. Well, I wouldn't go that far.
You really lucked out.
I wouldn't go that far that I lucked out. You know, it was not a fun situation, and it was very depressing. But nonetheless...
It was depressing for almost all of his authors.
You know, the book did well, in spite of the fact they didn't publish very many because they were rather angry at him, you know, and we had to bear the brunt of that, I'm sorry to say. But a lot of people liked the book, so anyway... then Bob Loomis at Random House called me up, actually, and asked me if I wanted to publish with him, and I did. And so I published Glianzu's Divorce, which is a book about acting and South Africa and the entertainment business and the structure of success and many other things.
Well, let's bring us up to date now with Yves Setu. This is a fascinating book. Tell me how you got the idea for this book. I see you're not wearing a tattoo.
No, I'm not. No, I'm not. How did I get the idea for the tattoo? Well, the way I get a lot of ideas, which is it suddenly came to me. My first job, as it says in the book, was reading for a director. And he is the person that, through whom I learned about the Holocaust and the Nazis. And all these years I have been reading one thing and another and keeping up to date. And I had read a book. Recently, a whole new sort of book has begun to come out about daily life in Nazi Germany. And there are more and more of these books. And they were fascinating. And I began to be interested in daily life in Nazi Germany. And then I was interested in the idea that I found actually in Robert Lifton's book, Nazi Doctors, that the gas chambers were constructed for German mental patients. That was a fascinating thing for me to find out. Like everybody else, I am, you know, interested in how this could have happened, you know. And I've always heard the notion that, you know, we all have this in us and we're all capable of doing it, okay, mass murder somehow, given the right circumstances. And I don't know that I believe this, so I just became interested in finding out more and more about what went on in Nazi Germany that might have contributed to this mentality, you know, this attitude.
One of the reasons that this attitude developed, I believe, as you express in Eve's Tattoo, is that women in Nazi Germany actually found Hitler attractive.
Well, they seem to, yes. They definitely seem to. In Claudia Kunz's book, Mothers in the Fatherland, she talks about how when Hitler was in prison in the 20s, women did fundraising to keep the Nazi Party going. And the whole book, which I recommend highly, Mothers in the Fatherland, is about the contradiction that women, he absolutely hogtied women once he came into power, and the Nazi Party was always very male-oriented and very anti-liberationist anyway, and there had been in the Weimar Germany a big liberation movement for women. And, you know, they were rising up in the ranks and getting more professional jobs, and, you know, one of the first things he did when he came into power was to throw them all. They couldn't work anymore. No more professional women. That was it. Across the board. Out. Fired. So the Nazis, in fact, were very, very anti women's lib, whatever we want to call it. You know. But they supported him. They kept him going, and he would never have been able to survive, according to Ms. Kunz, had they not fundraised for him during this period.
And in fact, don't you point out that women became residents of Germany rather than citizens?
Well, single women. And one of the things he did do was he began to reward married and women with children especially. And single women were deemed, according to Racial Hygiene, which is another book I read, I can't remember the man's name who wrote it, sadly. It's a wonderful book, very interesting. Yes, under the race laws, single women were not citizens of the Reich. And this was particularly interesting to me because, of course, Hitler's girlfriend was a single woman, childless, a woman who wore makeup, designer clothing. You know, the perfect Nazi woman was someone who did not wear makeup and who was very earthy and plain and bore children, kind of, I sort of compare her in the book to sort of the idea of the hippie earth mother type of a person. It also interested me to find out in that book that the Nazis were very much into health food, organic food, homeopathic medicine, a lot of the things that we associate with peace-loving things. Hitler was a total vegetarian, rabid anti-smoker, teetotaler. You know.
What a guy.
Yeah, so I mean, you know, the old, as I said, point out in the book, the old meat aggression myth is a little bit...
Well, in Eve's Tattoo, a young woman named, actually not young, I guess she's 40.
Just turned 40.
Becomes obsessed after seeing a photograph of a German woman holding up in a defiant gesture her arm, and there is a tattoo. As the book progresses, I guess she, in a way, fantasizes as to who this woman was and what she did, so that you have many different situations that could have led to Eva's incarceration in the the concentration camp. You must have how many different scenarios?
About seven, maybe?
Perhaps.
Five or six? I don't know. Yeah, I mean, I don't think... She fantasizes based on reading, more or less as I did. She reads different books and fantasizes real situations based on the facts. Each of Eva's tales is based either on a, on some real account I took from a witness account or a fact I purloined from original source material, such as in the case of the unmarried animal lover woman who saves dogs and cats. And that I got there, there was a two books of original source materials called Nazism, Volume 1 and 2, which were published by Random House. And in there I found, I think it was in, no, it wasn't in there. It was in a book I bought in Germany called The Terror Terrain about the Gestapo. And it was a Gestapo memo that was sent to people who were about to be deported to Jews, about to be deported to concentration camps. It was a list of things you had to do before you left town on the train. And one of those things was to turn in your pets to the parish council. So once you have this fact, once I have this fact, I just fantasize what this must be like, you know. If
so each of these scenarios did have some basis in fact.
Oh, yes. And the others, a lot of the others are based, are facts I took from witness accounts, little facts to the side. A nurse who dispensed water on a platform and was, you know, kicked into a train, came from a witness account that I read. Initially, I did have at the back of this book an index of books that I used references, but then my editor didn't think that was right to have. I still wonder if I should have had it.
Not for a novel.
No, that's what he said.
No, you...
On the other hand, you know, I've had a lot of trouble in my career with people not understanding that I do research, and I'm very careful about it. During Cleans' divorce, for example, this woman called Carolyn C. in the L.A. Times totally lambasted me for a character, a mother character I had who got leprosy. Just went after me. This is ridiculous. She's a fool, da-da-da. I mean, just very mean. Fact is, I wanted this mother character to have leprosy, and I thought, well, that's very unrealistic. And then I walked one day into the news agent on the corner, and on the cover of the Wall Street Journal was an article about how people who stuff armadillos in Texas were getting leprosy from the bone marrow. So, you know, I'm quite careful about my research, and I have had trouble, you know, with people not believing me.
No, you're not. You're not the only one.
A Nazi. You know?
I wrote a novel that was published by St. Martin's Press in 1988, and it was centered around H.L. Mencken. And in the novel, Mencken is never referred to by the name Mencken. He's referred to as Harry, which was a nickname. The Baltimore Sun did a really long review of this rather slender book and charged that no one ever called Mencken Harry.
Oh.
No one ever called. Well, I knew that they had because I had also done my research and I'd gone to the Mencken Library after they'd opened it to the public, after the book was published, and I had not been in there before. I had gotten other sources. But I was able to look firsthand at Mencken scrapbooks, which I had not done in preparation for this book, and I open up the scrapbooks, and he has all of his correspondence to his mother and father, Christmas cards, and each one he would sign, "Love, Harry." And in fact, his father bought him a little printing press, and he was going to have business cards made, Harry Mencken, except that his father dropped the tray with the type and broke the R's. So he didn't have any R's, so he said it. He made it H.L. Mencken instead.
Oh,
so the, I mean, I was the same thing. I mean, I knew I was right because I had read the biographies and first count interviews with Mencken, and I knew this was correct. And besides that, it was fiction anyway. I could call him anything I wanted.
Sure, of course.
It didn't necessarily have to be Mencken because he was never referred to by Mencken. People assumed it was Mencken, and it was, but never did I say it was Minkin in the book. I only used Harry, so I know exactly what you're talking
about.
Yeah,
so, you know. Anyway,
it should be noted that all of the various scenarios that you had with regard to Eva are not correct, and that the final description of who Eva really was is completely different. I mean, it's almost it's a surprise, which we won't obviously spoil. Now, tell me about Eve's relationship with her boyfriend, which becomes compromised after she has the tattoo.
Yes. Well, Eve's boyfriend, Eve's boyfriend is French, and I think that she suspects that he's very angry all the time, and she suspects he won't talk about his past, his parents, anything. She suspects there's something odd about him, and I think that that he's not telling, or something that isn't right, something that isn't working. And she finds out when she gets the tattoo that he is Jewish by birth, but that basically he has been posing as a Catholic. He has been hiding his Jewish past. And this leads to her discovering some things about herself that aren't very attractive, such as some inherent anti-Semitism that she has that she didn't know about.
It should also be noted that part of Charles, I believe, is
Charlie.
Yeah. Part of the problem was that his parents were what you describe as catchers.
That's right. That's right. That's the reason, basically.
Could you define a catcher?
The Nazis employed some Jews to catch other Jews in Nazi Germany. So what they would do is they would go around, and when they spotted Jews who were in hiding, and the thing about being in hiding in Nazi Germany during the war was that you couldn't, unless you were walled up in an attic or some sort of thing like that, you couldn't just be in a house. You had to go out during the day, otherwise you were suspect because everybody was employed in the war effort or, you know, gone in the war or something like that. So you had to be out on the street, and the danger always was that you would run into somebody employed by the Nazis, a Jewish person employed by the Nazis, who might spot you as another Jewish person and turn you in, and that happened frequently. And so it turned out that this is what his parents had done to survive. And when he found this out, he himself went into hiding, in a way. I think also, I mean, in her case, I think she feels, you know, people have found her a little odd, but of course what's going on there is not a very attractive thing, which is that she thinks that she is totally liberal. She thinks she is a WASP with a heart. She thinks she is on a mission, and she is. But it turns out that she does also possess some anti-Semitic characteristics, and this is a terrible thing for her to find out. She's really horrified.
Like Eve, you yourself are not Jewish, are you?
I am half Jewish. My father's family is Jewish. My mother's family is Irish Catholic. I am a baptized and exorcised Catholic, and a confirmed Episcopalian, so I have all these things. I have expertise in every area here.
Got your fingers in every pie there.
Yeah, so I know what it's like.
Well, Emily, after writing Eve's tattoo, did you draw any conclusions about the nature of Nazism and what it did?
Yes, a couple. I did feel that the race laws and the clamp that they had on basically on motherhood and who was to give birth and who was not to give birth. I came to the conclusion that definitely the control of motherhood in any way by law is a totalitarian impulse, and that the absolute invasiveness of the laws that they had on Germans themselves, the sterilization laws, the euthanasia program, the idea that the government will decide who will be sterilized, you know, on the basis of, you know, whether or not your parents were chronic, you know, whether you have alcoholism in your family was one of them, for example, or epilepsy, or all kinds of different things, which I won't go into. But the idea that a government will make that kind of invasive law leads to no good. I mean, the perversity with which, you know, the mass killing was carried out on the Jews and other persons, that the depths of that perversity is very much linked, it seems to me, to the perversity of these, you know, laws at home, where, as I say in the book, you know, Hitler basically had his, you know, hands in the underpants of every German woman, you know, and that societies have got to be very careful about that, very, very careful. You know, motherhood is a sacred contract. It's not something that should be defined under the law, you know. I think you have to create a society in which everything, you know, it's conducive to having children, but once you start making laws about who can, who can't, you know, I think it's evil is what happens. It leads to some evil. Something is going on there. I don't think that you could have had, I'm not sure you would have had the mass killing without the mass breeding, and that these two things are intricately linked. You know, and it's not just a case that we're all beasts and, you know, given the chance to attack others, we will. I don't know that that's exactly the case. So that's one thing. The other thing is that people in chaos perceive control as freedom. And that's something also to be careful about. And we just had a really good illustration of that by David Duke rising up to where now he's, what is he, running for president now, this Nazi person. You know, but people who are in chaos, they perceive that a firm hand with control, somebody who really can control you, is freeing, you know, at first. And that's exactly what Hitler did. I can't remember what it was. It was something I was watching where somebody said, I think it was an English military expert from the period was saying that had Hitler been assassinated during the first assassination attempt, which was early in his reign, he would have been remembered as a great leader. Because he came in, I mean, he was anti-pornography, there was a lot of homeless people, he was going to clean that up, and he was going to give everybody a job, and he was going to, you know, send people who'd never been out of, you know, their tiny villages in their lives on vacation for the first time in their life, you know, and up the cultural standard, and he designed furniture, and he was, you know, amazing. He was amazing. And he was going to just take control of this decadent society and, you know, push for motherhood and family and all the things that we hear over and over and over. You know, that's what he said. He didn't come in there and say, yeah, I'm going to kill these people and I'm going to beat up your... Yeah, he didn't do that at all. And everybody went, oh, yes, yes, you know, it's out of control. Where there's too much poverty, there's too much unemployment, you know, what is going to happen to us? And they went for that person who had that firm, rigid control. You know, and it's very dangerous.
Well, I wonder if that could happen here. We have a feeling that nobody is really in control of our government today.
That's right. I mean, it is a dangerous period for us in that way. I don't know that it can happen here. I think that we do have this Constitution, and generally I think the American people, I find, when it comes down to it, it takes them a while, but when it comes down to it, they usually make a good decision, you know. But they have to be, they have to be kind of hit over the head with it a number of times before they see it. But so far, I haven't seen them in my lifetime really do anything too crazy. I mean, he was not voted in, David Duke, thank God. Finally and utterly, he wasn't. But it is a time. I mean, one thing is in writing this book, the book ends at when Nelson Mandela gets out of prison. And when I was going over it, which was last year after the Gulf War, I was really shocked because the book had a kind of ominous tone, which was leading to like something is going to happen from this chaos. And it had to do with living through last year, going up to the Gulf War, where, I don't know about you, but I live in the West Village. It was total chaos. I mean, I've never seen crime that bad. It was unbelievable. And the next thing I know, you know, I woke up in August and we had gone to war. From Nelson Mandela's release in prison in February, I think it was, where everybody was saying, gee, you know, communism is over and Nelson Mandela's out of prison and maybe there'll be peace on earth. And that's how everybody felt 6 months previously, too. Suddenly we've gone to war. I mean, if you had said, the day Nelson Mandela got out of prison, if I'd said to you, well, we're going to be at war in a foreign land in 7 months, you would have said, oh, that's ridiculous. It's impossible. You know? So I think it's, you know, it's just...
I was hearing, somebody on the radio the other day contemplating the fact that Bush may well, in order to rally the nation behind him and to show that he's a firm leader, may well stage a war someplace else.
Well, people, I know that there is that opinion. There is that opinion.
That's scary when you think about it.
It is scary. I myself don't think that's going to happen because I do think that people have finally gotten it. You know, they finally, generally, almost everyone I speak to believes that Mr. Bush is in total denial about what's going on in his country. You know, where, oh, it's 10% unemployment, and that isn't even the entire figure. I mean, a lot of people I know are out of work. I'm sure you know people have been laid off, you know, in every business. It's not a joke anymore. Nobody can come out. You can't come out anymore and go, the recession's over, and everybody's doing fine. It's just not true, and we all know it isn't true. And he may think it's true. And he may try to have a war, but I don't think a war is going to put a Band-Aid on our situation, you know. Something has to be done.
I got into this argument with Tom Clancy. You know his stuff? You know,
not really.
Hunt for Red October,
yeah,
and some of these. But he's an ardent right-winger.
Oh, is he? Uh-huh.
And he and I were arguing over the invasion of Grenada that happened during the Reagan administration. A little country down there. They had 200 Cuban troops. And he felt that it was all right as the president, as commander-in-chief, can go ahead and wage war any place he wants. And my feeling was that it must, to declare war, he must have the advice and consent of Congress.
Mm-hmm.
And he didn't do that. He just did it.
Right.
In effect, Bush invaded Iraq.
That's right.
He just did it. But conservatives such as Clancy believe that the president has the power to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And I always thought the power came from the people, through our representatives in Congress, and they determine who we attack.
Right. Well, of course, by the time they were asked, it was too late to renege. So many people were over there. I mean,
but
that's what I felt too. I mean, see, I felt like I live in a democracy, and I was not consulted as to whether or not we went to war, and that seems a very big decision to me. That really affects my life, whether or not this country goes to war, and I didn't have a vote. You know, by the time Congress was consulted, it was several months later, wasn't it? But by the time they had the vote, they just took a vote in Congress whether or not to sustain this. I was under the impression that after the Vietnam War, we'd made some, I don't know, law amendment, I don't know, something that would prevent him from sending that many people overseas without consulting Congress and my representatives.
Oh, we can invade Panama, Grenada, we can bomb Libya, we can...
400,000 guys overnight? I mean, shocking.
In terms of that war, we lucked out. I mean, went in there. The Iraqis didn't. Hundreds of thousands of them died, but we got out with what, 200 casualties, and we're there for a brief amount of time, and everybody felt good. So, Bush came out ahead.
Yes, he temporarily did.
And after, you know, it took a long time for this to sink in. I mean, we all had a certain degree of pride that our armed forces were so good, but then. Really,
yeah, we did. I mean, the weapons were great. They worked for predominantly. On the other hand, you could say that there didn't seem to be much enemy action. And if they'd had to really fight planes up in the sky and do all their stuff,
weren't.
We don't
Iraq
know.
Was not, in spite of what the administration said, they weren't prepared to wage
really
war against how many countries were there anyway, in addition to us.
Right. And we'll never, you know, you just can't get over the fact that Saddam Hussein, who, as I had an interesting thing happen, which I write also a column for Interview Magazine, and I made a joke. Bush's war crimes trials for Saddam, it just never came through, referring to something else. Actually, I was referring to Halloween. It just isn't coming through. And the fact checkers, the first time I've ever been fact-checked for humor, it kind of amuses me. But anyway, they called up the White House to ask about war crimes trials for Saddam Hussein. They denied that Bush had ever said that, which I found fascinating, because, of course, he did say that, and he said it on a news broadcast and said it over and over again. This man is a devil. This man is Hitler. And, you know, I'm talking about war crimes trials for him later. And not only are there no war crimes trials, but, of course, he's still in power and nothing much happened. I mean, it's the most peculiar thing. I don't know. You know, but Bush does have this thing that he does, which is he just keeps, you know, I want to write a column on sound bites because I think sound bites have changed the world. Sound bites are very, very dangerous, another dangerous thing. What is the difference between propaganda and news, for example? A sound bite, which is basically like a commercial where you repeat the same thing over and over, it doesn't matter what people say to you, just keep repeating the same phrase, that's the way news programs are basically run now. I had the experience of being on that Night Watch program on one of those TV sets, not in the room. And this is when I discovered how sound bites work, that you can't converse on something. They don't want you to converse. You look like a nutcase if you really want to have a conversation. You're meant to come in with your position in three sound bites and just repeat it mindlessly over and over like a commercial, you know, slogan. But, you know, one of the slogans with Bush kept repeating is, it's getting better. You know, the recession's almost over. The economy is good, he said over and over to get elected, which I couldn't believe either. But anyway, like, people believed it, you know. People believe these things. What was it, the soundbite that we got from David Duke was, a man can change. I had perfectly, you know, intelligent people say to me, don't you think a man can change? I said, well, you know, generally, people become more conservative in their older age, frankly. You know?
Well, he could change. He could get worse.
Yeah, he could become a hippie overnight.
He could get his white robes out of the closet and put them on again.
The point of this was, but anyway, I do think sound bites, what was this apropos? I was yammering on about something, but...
Well, we're really out of time, Emily Prager, so I just, one last, we could go on talking the rest of the afternoon, no doubt. But what is on the horizon? More literature from Emily Prager?
Yes, more literature. I have another, I guess, 100 million books to write. I don't know. Yeah, I want to write more books. I want to write books. I've done journalism for a very long time as well, you know. I've been a columnist, and I'll continue to be a columnist. But in a way, I don't know.
You want to do some real writing, they say.
I've been doing all this real writing for a long time.
I'll rephrase that. You've been doing a lot of journalism, but you want to do some more real writing.
Yes, I'll do more books. You know, when you come out, you've got an actual creation here. See, makes a noise, everything.
It's a very good feeling too to take the products of your creativity, yes, and hold it in your hands and say,
yes, it is. I mean, I hope people
that.
Keep reading. That's something I wish will happen.
Eve's Tattoo is a very moving, very well done book. Emily Prager, thank you very much.
Thank you.